From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit teachers demand a forensic audit of the district's books. House Republicans say no.
It's all about money. So if you ask for a forensic audit, you're asking for more money to find out what went wrong, to find out who did wrong.
Senator Gary Peters on turning Willow Run into a national center on autonomous vehicle research, meeting Google and Apple head on.
We've got something in Michigan that they do not have in California, and that is snow and ice.
A new documentary looks at human trafficking in Michigan. We talked to a survivor ensnared by a sex trafficker when she was a teen.
When I ran into him, I was hungry, hadn't really slept, and so at that time, he was just saying all the right things.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some teachers in Detroit were out selling lemonade over the weekend at Eastern Market, trying to raise money to pay for a forensic audit of the district's books. Coming up, why do they want it and why do Republicans not? Well, here's a hint. The district's been under state control since 2009. But first, there are some important issues that seem to be mired in GOP resistance on Capitol Hill these days. Federal aid for Flint and hearings on a new justice for the U.S. Supreme Court. What's the latest, and what will it take to get both efforts moving through the Senate? Let's get into that now as we welcome U.S. Senator Gary Peters. And it is good to have you here in the Stateside studio, Senator Peters.
There's no better place than being right across the desk from you, Cynthia. It's great to be with you today.
Let's start right with Flint, Senator. If I'm a mom in Flint, it has been over 2 years since my water was switched to the untreated river water. I'm worried my kids have been poisoned by lead. We're using bottled water for everything. And it's been nearly 4 months since the president declared that state of emergency, and Congress is still debating over whether and how the federal government should help. Do I have a right to be angry and disheartened if I'm that mom in Flint?
No question about it. It is unacceptable that it's taken so long to move forward. We continue to push it aggressively. Hopefully, we've got a path in sight right now, but people can't keep living on bottled water and not trusting the filters. Folks are frustrated. I've been out delivering bottled water, and folks are appreciative of that, but they're also at the very end of their patience, which they should be, and I totally agree with that. So we have been working to get some federal money that will assist what the state is doing, but certainly the state has the primary responsibility. The state needs to step up and needs to do a whole lot more than it already has, but we'll need to be there with the federal money as well. You've got a disaster, and you look throughout this country. If people have been hit by a disaster, the federal government helps, and the people of this country help folks in that area. And so now we have a new bill, which is a WARDA bill, which is a water infrastructure bill, that we have inserted the language in that bill. It's part of the main body of the bill. It passed out of committee 2 weeks ago by a 19-1 vote, so we feel very good about that. And now hopefully it'll get to the Senate floor. I'm not sure the timeline on the Senate floor, but potentially could be in the next couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks.
How much money are we talking about?
It's a broad bill, not just for Flint. It's about water infrastructure generally. One thing that's clear is that we've got issues all over the country when it comes to water infrastructure. Lead is an issue in every state, especially older urban areas, but in rural areas as well. It's everywhere. So the total package that we have inserted in there is about $250 million. Part of that is grants that the city of Flint will have to apply for. There's an initial $100 million for infrastructure improvements to pull out lead service lines, for example, make the kinds of infrastructure improvements that are necessary. But that's a grant, and you have to apply for it. But the only communities that can apply for it are those that are under an emergency declaration. Currently, that's only Flint that could apply for it, although we think there may be a smaller town in Ohio that may be getting an emergency declaration soon. But the majority of that money, or a vast majority, should go to Flint. Then we've also increased a loan authority that could provide up to $700 million, or actually probably in excess of $700 million of loan authority. And then we've plussed up a number of other programs for lead abatement from HUD, for the CDC. These are going to be national grants, so any city can apply for them. But of course, because of the situation Flint's in, they're going to be at the top of the list.
I'm speaking today with U.S. Senator Gary Peters with us. And let's get over to the fact that it has been now since March 16th, since President Obama announced that he wanted Appeals Court Judge Merrick Garland to replace the late Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. Have we now not gone past the time when confirmation hearings should typically have begun?
Oh, we have. Yeah, normally they would have already begun. In fact, I met with him about, I guess, close to 2 weeks ago, which was the day after when they normally would start, but still had had not occurred. He is a very bright individual, has impeccable legal credentials, centrist, someone who really takes seriously that scales of justice, trying to hear both sides. And it's the type of person you would really want to have as a Supreme Court justice, as someone who is going to be even-handed. When he was appointed to the Court of Appeals, I believe it was 76 votes I think he got. It was in the high 70s, both Democrats, Republicans coming together to approve him. Here he is, a man who was the federal prosecutor for the Oklahoma bombing case, known as a strong law and order individual. This is somebody that the American people would feel very comfortable with, which is why I believe the Republicans don't want to have him in a hearing in the public and have the television cameras covering that hearing, because the people would see that this is the kind of person that you would feel comfortable putting in the highest court in the land.
After Donald Trump became the presumptive GOP nominee by winning Indiana last week, the conservative site Red State called on the Senate Republicans to confirm Judge Garland. Managing editor Leon Wolf basically said, look, there's absolutely no reason to drag this out any further or watch as President Clinton, in his words, nominate somebody radically more leftist and 10 to 15 years younger.
I think it's a tough position for Republicans to be in. It's not politically smart in my mind, and the fact that a large majority of the American people think you should at least have hearings. Now, whether or not someone votes yes or no, that's what the process is. But it is a process that is clearly outlined in the United States Constitution. This is a shall. This is not a maybe. The president shall nominate and the Senate shall give advice and consent. And so this is a violation of our duty. We're not doing our job. The Republican majority in the Senate simply says we're not going to do our job for this year. And I think it's important for listeners to realize the time, too. If we do not appoint a justice to the Supreme Court and we wait, as some Republicans or the leadership have said, let's wait till after the election, start the process all over again, that would mean we'd have the longest vacancy in the history of the Supreme Court, with one exception, and that was during the American Civil War, which was not a real good time in our history. We certainly was a dysfunctional time in our history when people were taking up arms against each other and shooting in a battlefield. That would be the only time that we had such a long opening in the Supreme Court, because the court cannot function without nine. You need to have finality in the law. You can't have split decisions. You need to have finality. Our founding fathers knew that, which is why they were very clear this is a shall.
Could we see a scenario that come November and the Democratic candidate wins the White House, could there be a rush in the lame duck session to get Judge Garland through before the new president comes in?
I think that's very possible. You could see that. I think there's also a very strong possibility that the Democrats will win control of the Senate. And so if we have both control of the Senate and a Democratic president, you definitely may see Republicans change their view.
Which is probably why Red State said Merrick Garland, the fact that he exists is an option right now is a gift that should not be squandered. Let's just shift to autonomous vehicles, which brings you to Ann Arbor today. You've got some White House involvement.
We do. We are bringing in some White House folks, Jason Miller from the Economic Advisors. This is a very big development happening here in the greater Ann Arbor area. You know, the University of Michigan is a leader when it comes to new automotive technologies, safety features, vehicle-to-vehicle communications, eventually leading to autonomous vehicles. From a safety perspective, just the new technologies that are coming online, before you get to the self-driving vehicles, just the fact that our cars are going to talk to each other and constantly be communicating. It is believed that in just the next few years, we can eliminate up to 80% of all car crashes in this country. I mean, that is phenomenal. At a time when nearly 40,000 people die every year on our highways, 80% fewer accidents is a big deal, not to mention the millions of people who get injured every year. It's going to be incredible safety, but also brings a whole new, really a dynamic to mobility as well. It can relieve congestion. It can mean fewer needs for infrastructure because cars can travel closer together. But I want to make sure that we continue to be the leader for that technology here in Michigan. Ann Arbor is specifically the center of that universe with the University of Michigan and where we are located by all of the major research centers for the big automobile companies. The University of Michigan now has M-City, which is a test track on the North Campus that is about 35 acres, mm-hmm. fully subscribed, doing incredible research work.
Giving it real world conditions.
Absolutely, to be able to test it before these technologies, before they actually go out on the road. But what we really need is a national testing center, a much larger facility, and that has been identified. It's the old Willow Run facility in Ypsilanti. It is 350 acres, so it's about 10 times the size of M-City. University of Michigan will lead that effort as well. And the Willow Run facility can be the place where folks from all over the country will converge to do that testing. We are competing with Track, for example, in California. The Google folks and Apple and other some of those folks who are doing this want to do that. But as I say, we've got something in Michigan that they do not have in California, and that is snow and ice. And we're proud of that. And you cannot test vehicles if they're not in four seasons. This is a four-season track that can test all sorts of applications from gravel roads to highways to surface streets. All that can happen at Willow Run, and we can be the center of the universe when it comes to the future of autonomous vehicles, and with the University of Michigan leading that effort.
And give us a sense, how far along are we in the process of making this happen?
Well, the Willow Run site's been identified. Mm-hmm. The state of Michigan will be stepping up shortly to make a purchase coming from Racer Trust, which is part of the reorganization with General Motors. They will be putting in investments. We're looking to get some federal government investments. That's part of our meeting here today, is to get investments from the federal government and a recognition from NHTSA, the Highway Traffic Safety folks, that this is a necessary piece to really drive auto safety in this country. And then we'll have the private manufacturers as well. This is going to be a public-private partnership with the major automakers. And they all have to be at one track. Every automaker has their own track, but autonomous vehicles and vehicle-to-vehicle communications means that a Toyota has to talk to a Ford, and a Ford's got to talk to a GM, and then a Nissan. You know, all these cars have to work in one place, and the Willow Run facility is just perfectly positioned to do that. Now we have to make it a reality.
70 years after World War II, what a great way to bring Willow Run back to the national forefront.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it's interesting. The other piece for Willow Run, because it is an airfield, and as you said, it was the building the B-24 bombers.
Right.
We think it also could be the center for another emerging industry that can put our state at the forefront, and that's unmanned aerial vehicles, the drones. Same kind of technology that is used in autonomous vehicles is used in unmanned aerial vehicles. It's a airfield as well, and if in the future unmanned aerial vehicles need to be able to communicate and operate in an environment with autonomous vehicles on the ground as well. So it's a perfect synergy bringing it all together and making sure that our state continues to be the center of the universe for the auto industry, as well as being a driving force in a new industry that promises up to 700,000 jobs, and that's in unmanned aerial vehicles.
Senator Gary Peters, it's always great to see you. Thank you so much for being with us today on Stateside.
Great to be with you, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The headlines out of Georgia were horrifying. It was January 2015. Elroy Runyon and his wife, June, wanted to buy a vintage Ford Mustang convertible. So they placed an ad on Craigslist. They soon got a reply, and the couple headed for what they hoped would be a meeting with a seller, hoping they would be able to buy Elroy's dream car. Their bodies were discovered days later in a pond. They had both been shot in the head. A man named Ronnie Towns was charged with murdering the couple, and police departments around the nation realized the need for a safe haven to conduct internet transactions. The City of Lapeer Police Department recently took action. It put up a special sign in its parking lot, and it reads, Internet Purchase Exchange Location, this area, under video surveillance. Lapeer Police Chief Todd Alexander is with us now. Chief, you put that sign up April 7th. What kind of response have you gotten?
It's been overwhelming, actually. We've had people at least every other day using the exchange location, and when we posted it on our Facebook page, we got a response that we reached 580,000 people.
So that says you really did strike a chord, that people everywhere, like I saw that picture and went, oh my goodness, what a great idea. What gave you that idea and why now? I'm wondering, was there some incident in Lapeer that prompted you to do this?
No, we really haven't had any incidents per se. We've had some exchanges where people didn't think they got what they had paid for and things like that. But actually, I was approached by one of our city commissioners, Joshua Atwood, and also by our city manager, Dale Kerbison. And we spoke about the idea, and I did some research and found there were these signs out there being used by other departments, and thought it was a easy idea to initiate. And so we went ahead and posted it, and it went from there.
And one would assume this has not cost you much in terms of money and manpower. I mean, basically the cost of a sign. So it would not be difficult for other departments to follow suit.
No, very cost effective. And it gives like you mentioned, a neutral place for people to exchange their items. It's not like a shopping center. You could meet at a shopping center, but you really don't know what your surroundings are when you go into those locations. You might meet the person you're there, but he might also have some other people there waiting for you also. So this way, it's just a neutral location that's safe for everybody to use.
Well, certainly knowing that this sign and this purchase exchange location is right at the police department parking lot, I think if somebody was up to no good, they would be a no-show, one might assume.
Well, I think it would deter them, without a doubt. I think it's still important for people to do research on the items that they are purchasing. Like the saying goes, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. So they got to be aware of those situations. And, of course, never give out their credit cards or information like that that could lead to problems down the road. But the majority of the exchanges, at least what we see in our lot since we've posted the sign, is they're smaller items, whether it be jewelry or bags or things like that. There's been no issues whatsoever. And, of course, the other side of it is we've noticed we've had a little bit of increase of even child exchanges in our parking lot for custody exchange and things like that. So it also gives an area for that to happen also.
And, indeed, the area is under video surveillance, so you would have CCTV footage if anything bad did happen.
Exactly. We have a well-lit parking lot, so even if it's done in the evening hours, it's very well lit, and you can see the other vehicles and everything in the lot. So it's a very neutral, safe location.
Lapeer Police Chief Todd Alexander. Chief, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside today.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. When Ingham County's prosecutor Stuart Dunnings III was recently charged with a wide range of prostitution-related crimes, it refocused attention on human trafficking in Michigan, people being manipulated, forced to sell their bodies for sex, or used for cheap labor.
It's something that we have never been without in the United States. We even fought a war. Everybody knows that. And there is an assumption that that indeed ended slavery. It did not end slavery.
That's a clip from a new documentary on human trafficking in Michigan called Break the Chain. It's premiering next month. And filmmaker Laura Swanson is with us. Now, welcome to the program, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And with us also is Debbie. She is a survivor of human trafficking. She is in Break the Chain, and it is very good to have you with us, Debbie.
Thank you for having me, too.
Laura, what goal did you set for yourself in this film?
Well, I think there were many goals to begin with because this issue is incredibly complicated. But I think the main thing is to get people who aren't used to this issue possibly interested in it and to kind of question what they typically see in the news and media.
And in all of that, what do you think are some of the main myths and misconceptions that you're hoping to bust with this film?
I think the main one is that it doesn't look how we think it looks. Like, I think everybody has this idea of a perfect victim, and those don't really exist. You know, the Taken scenarios.
The Liam Neeson movies.
Karate chopping yeah. people to safety everywhere, everything. I mean, certainly that does happen, but that's not the majority of the cases. And I think people really need to start reframing the way in which they see human trafficking so that we can amend our laws and legal system to accompany what we need to do to get resources and to provide the best support for victims and survivors.
You feature two people in this film, one a labor trafficking survivor and one a sex trafficking survivor. Mm-hmm. I want to listen now to a clip in which a woman explains why so many who are sexually trafficked stay with their pimps, the very people who are imprisoning them.
It turns into us against them kind of way, like right. her and her pimp against us. So she's not going to trust us because a lot of times the pimp has been abused her so much and manipulated her so much that in her mind she believes that that's all she has and that's the only person who is going to be good to her.
Debbie, you are a survivor of human trafficking. Does this clip reflect what you knew?
Well, when I was trafficked, I was 13 years old, and so the person I was with him until as an adult, and so he kind of raised me. So for me, it was really identifying him more as a caregiver than anything.
13. How did that begin?
I was at the Jackson County Fair that day, and, you know, in my mind, I was coming from a bad home situation, was looking in and out of the foster care system, and wanted some type of family. And in the 70s, you know, you heard about fairs and how they were like a family.
Yes.
All the people that didn't fit in anywhere were like a big family. So I went there searching that day for a family and happened to run into him. When I ran into him, I was hungry, hadn't really slept. And so at that time, he was just saying all the right things. You know, he was talking to me. He was paying attention to me. He was interested in what I had to say. He was very nice to me.
Everything you needed.
Everything I needed. And then by that evening, it was, why don't we leave the fair and you just show me around your town? So once I got in the vehicle with him, within an hour, we were headed towards Detroit.
And then what?
I stayed there with him for the first night. The next day, he brought me back to Jackson and told me that he was going to give me $20. And if I wanted to be with him, that I could be with him and I would be sitting at the bus stop in an hour. If I didn't want to be with him, there was $20, basically have a nice life. But I'd already been dealing with a lot of abandonment issues. My mother had left when I was about 10 years old. My father, you know, was a chronic alcoholic, and, you know, I was in and out of foster care. And so this was another person that wanted to leave, that was that treated me well. And so I sat at that bus stop for that whole hour. And in my mind was that he was not coming back. So I was kind of relieved when I seen him pull back up. I got in the car, and at that time, I still didn't know what he had planned for me. You know, this was just somebody that just took interest in me and was nice to me. When I got back in the car that day, went back to Detroit with him, and by the next day, I was prostituting.
And how long did that last?
Until 1999. He was arrested in 1992. The FBI actually arrested him and tried to get him on a prostitution empire, but could only arrest him for tax evasion. Mm. But for me, it was now I'm out here on my own again, and then started substance abuse just to mask a lot of the feelings and the hopelessness that I felt. And then it wasn't until 1999 that I had made a choice to get out of everything.
When I think of 13 years old, I mean, the mind boggles to think about that. Mm-hmm. But this is the kind of thing you're finding, isn't it, Laura, in your research?
Yeah, I'm finding that a lot of it is, you know, people want jobs and people are in situations in which they come from poor home environments or are vulnerable in some way. And someone approaches them understanding that person's vulnerability and is going to use it for, you know, some sort of financial gain. And you know, I really don't understand when people say that the choices made by survivors are the ones to blame, because you're 13 years old. You know what I mean? You're 13 years old. You didn't have anybody. How are you expected to make adult decisions?
How much of a problem is this in Michigan? I know it's hard to pin down with statistics, isn't it?
Yes, that's the biggest problem.
Why is that?
Well, because if you think about how people have generally viewed human trafficking in one sort of, you know, trafficking schema or scenario, and you think about how we're constantly learning about how this issue actually happens and it's adapting and changing, and laws and things like that need to change with it, we haven't had accurate representation and accurate reporting numbers, because this is a crime much like sexual assault and domestic violence where people don't necessarily report it or identify themselves as being victims or survivors, and most certainly don't trust law enforcement. So you're not going to get the appropriate statistics. But what you can say is we know that it's a huge business because money's involved. We can see the connection through everything that we do with, you know, finances in our world. And if it's that big, if it's like a $32 billion industry per year, we can see that, you know, it's everywhere because it's humans.
Well, I am thinking of that house fire in January in Novi.
Yes.
You had five Mexican undocumented immigrants who were killed. They were all living in the basement of a home owned by the owner of the restaurant where the five men worked. There were even two teenagers. Smoke detectors had been disabled. The basement was not to code. There was no egress. And no one in the neighborhood knew that they were there. People were living. And the owner and his wife actually are facing federal charges of harboring these undocumented immigrants. So it tells us, doesn't it, that it is everywhere and we probably don't understand that.
Right. a lot of times we don't, well, for me, I didn't identify myself as a victim. Mm-hmm. I was always told that it was my choice that I wanted to be there. And so after a while, you start believing it, especially when you don't have, what else do you have to go back to? My father was not somebody that was concerned about me disappearing. And then actually when I was arrested and put into a juvenile home, he actually took me right back to that person and was paid and then drove back off. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a lot of times people don't talk about or say what's going on in their lives because they feel that this is the best it's going to be.
And for the labor trafficking, that's everywhere, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I think it's everywhere. And I think we have to be kind of realistic about how we're all connected to it. I mean, if you think about our society and we're kind of built on cheap labor. Mm-hmm. And we really like to not pay as much for things as other people in other countries pay for things. And I think that's where we all become connected to it, not even just by the places we frequent, but the things that we buy on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing today, Debbie?
Well, today I am a certified peer support specialist, mm-hmm. And that is a person with lived experience that help other people that are still struggling in their recovery. Mm-hmm. For me, once I got myself out of that environment, I found that, you know, I needed more help than just getting off drugs. And I had to go in and receive mental health services because of the trauma that I experienced.
And such formative years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was just getting in there and talking to somebody about my history and the trauma that I've experienced and the abandonment issues and things like that. It really helped me. And then in that process, they talked about, actually, Obama had talked about peer support and people being hired to be peer support specialists. And so now it is a career path for me. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of training for the state on health and wellness and recovery from any type of a trauma or experiences that they have. I'm in prison right now working with the women and some of the men to become certified peers so that they can help other people that are coming into those environments. Because for years, I never talked about my history or my past and didn't know that I needed services. So,
what do you hope, Debbie, will come from people watching Break the Chain, watching Laura's film?
Well, I think that it'll bring awareness. A lot of times we hear people say, well, what does this have to do with me, or how is this going to affect me and my family? You know, and sometimes I think about, well, you know, at the fair that day, how many girls did he talk to before he talked to me? You know, I'm sure I'm not the first person that he talked to that day. And I took my son to a fair, and I was looking at all the young girls that were at that fair. Most of them come there with their friends, not their family, and, you know, and they're just hanging out, and they're vulnerable. So, you know, just realizing that being more a part of what your kids are doing, a lot of times families are so multitasking, and you may or may not have two people in the home, but they're constantly working, trying to meet the responsibilities of, you know, of parenting and bills.
Financial responsibilities. Yep. Sure.
And, you know, and the kids are out there raising themselves sometimes, and they're not always meeting the most. Like, I have my daughter right now is just broke up with her boyfriend and moved into one of her girlfriend's homes. And her girlfriend is her same age, but she's stripping. And I think she's working at an escort agency. And so I try to tell my daughter, you know, don't get lured in by the attractiveness of all the money that she's bringing in and the possessions that she has, because it can be glamorous when you think about it. Like, I want all of these things, and look how fast she's making the money. And so my fear is that she would be tempted just based on the fact that, you know, her friend is doing mm-hmm. it. Her friend might rationalize or justify, you know, some of the severity. But then I think about what her friend is going to go through later on, because even though she may feel like she has control right now, there is a lot of psychological damage going on at the same time.
That you can certainly testify to. Mm-hmm. Laura, you're mm-hmm. putting the final touches on your film.
Yes.
And you're going to be premiering it in Okemos on May 10th.
Mm-hmm.
How will you get this out for people to be able to see?
Well, that's kind of what we're working on right now, because we've had a lot of people interested in figuring out ways to distribute this, maybe through universities or even high schools, using it for trainings in some sort of sense. So we're premiering the film, and then we're going to have a whole bunch of feedback forms where anybody who's at the premiere gets to talk about the ways in which they think this film is going to be best distributed. And we've also had an interest from a certain nonprofit agency to possibly executive produce and help get more funding to do more specific stuff. So we're not 100% sure, but what I know that I want is I want this to be able to be available to everyone. Because I think that that's the most important thing, is not limiting information just to people who have access to information, you know.
Laura Swanson is a documentary filmmaker. Her documentary, Break the Chain, as we say, premieres May 10th in Okemos. Debbie is a human trafficking survivor who is in the film. And it was a pleasure to meet both of you and talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, yeah. Nice to meet you.
Thank you for having us.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, as we know, Detroit public schools have been controlled by the state since 2009. Yet the latest emergency manager says the district will not be able to meet its obligations after June 30th. Detroit teachers want to know, how did the district run up so much debt under all of these emergency managers? Republicans voted down an audit provision when the State House passed its DPS aid package last week, which raises the question, why are House Republicans saying no to an audit? Let's turn now to Bridge Magazine's Chastity Pratt-Dossie. Good to have you with us, Chastity.
Hello.
With Detroit's public schools where they're at on the verge of imminent financial collapse, how important is a forensic audit right now, as the teachers are calling for?
The difference between a regular annual internal audit and a forensic audit is really important, because in a forensic audit, a lot of times they're looking for wrongdoing. They're looking for where the district may have skirted the law or broken the law. And so while the teachers want to know where the money went or where the money is, a forensic audit would not only say that, but what went wrong and who did it wrong.
And in other words, a possible court action.
Possible court action. You see a lot of forensic audits done as a precursor to some kind of court action. It would not just tell us where the money is, but what went wrong.
Now, emergency manager Judge Stephen Rhodes says he welcomes an audit. I don't know if he's saying he welcomes a forensic audit or the annual audit, but he says he welcomes an audit, but what? They don't have the money to do it.
You know, it's one of those things. It's how much do you want to pay? It could cost, you know, $500,000. It could cost $10 million. How deep do you want the dig to be? Because a district the size of DPS, they have hundreds and thousands of expenditures and vendors. And you could, you know, look at every line on every purchase order and every contract. And that could take years and it could take a lot of money. So it's how much money do you want to spend and how deep do you want to go with this? So the teachers are saying, you know, with their lemonade stand, you know, that they had over the weekend, that they want to raise some money, $500,000, to do a forensic audit. Well, you know, it could go way deeper than the internal audits go every year. But again, you could spend $2 million and even go deeper. And with a district like Detroit Public Schools already teetering, you know, that's a lot of money.
And the fact that we're seeing one principal after another involved in this scandal with vendor Norman Shy, it certainly would be top of mind as far as where is money going and whose fingerprints are on it. And we saw Detroit Democrat Brian Banks. He tried to get an audit inserted into that House package of bills last week to restructure DPS, but it was defeated straight along party lines.
Again, it costs money. This whole thing, this whole, you know, fight over House bills and Senate bills and whether or not DPS needs $33 million to start a new district, or $200 million or $275 million, which is a new number I heard today. It's all about money. So if you ask for a forensic audit, you're asking for more money to find out what went wrong, to find out who did wrong.
But is there also a sense of being afraid of what it might show and what that might say about the series of five emergency managers?
Well, that's definitely what the teachers will say. If you don't want to pay to find out where the money went, then you must have something to hide. And let's be honest, since 2009, we all know emergency managers appointed by the state have overseen the district, and the finances didn't get better. The finances got worse. So if the Senate and the House really want to know what their emergency managers were up to, they would do this forensic audit and let the chips fall where they may. That's what the teachers are saying. But again, you have Republicans are saying, we've spent enough money on this. We're spending way more than we want to spend. You know, every year Detroit Public Schools gets an audit anyway, and they have a deficit elimination plan. Let's get this behind us as cheaply as possible is what you're hearing from some of the Republicans.
So we know it was voted down in the House. Do we have any idea of what the Senate thinks? For example, Senator Jeff Hansen, who was the point person in that effort to craft a DPS rescue package, and he managed to pull off something that had bipartisan support. Do we have any hint as to his thoughts on this?
when you look at the Senate side of things, they look at the audits we've seen. They look at the deficit elimination plans. You know, they come out quarterly with new reports on where the deficit is in Detroit public schools. And they pretty much know, you know, how deep the hole is at this point. They just want to get out of the hole, get DPS on some firm footing and give it enough resources to move forward. So the concentration on the Senate side has not been as much on a forensic audit. The teachers, I think they're really pushing that. For years now, the school board, which gets, you know, no attention and no love because they have no power, has been asking for a forensic audit for years. This isn't a new idea, but you're seeing it come from a really grassroots level of teachers saying, let's do this, and the school board. In the legislature, I don't think the debate is that loud over whether to do a forensic audit. It really is, you know, how much they should give Detroit Public Schools to keep the district open and to keep it moving forward.
But you got to think, if it's taxpayer funding that would do all of that coming from all over the state, you know, I mean, you kind of see why the teachers are saying, well, don't they want to know before they vote right. to send us these millions of dollars exactly, you know, where the money pits and what's been going on?
Well, it would be good accounting to know moving forward, how do you prevent the same mistakes from happening again? We're not just talking about these principals, but if there was sure. widespread wrongdoing, wouldn't you want to know, shouldn't you, you know, make sure that these things don't happen again? That's the argument here. But, I mean, you run up against the money argument. How much money do we want to spend on that? Do we really want to see who's at fault? And it's so circular. People point fingers at each other. It's your fault, the Republicans. No, it's your fault, Detroit. You don't want to know what happened. Yes, we do. It becomes a circular argument that moves no one ahead. But you're right, Cindy. People are saying if you want this district to move forward and move forward in a way that's meaningful, you got to know what went wrong to prevent it from happening again. Is it going to happen? Republicans are in charge. It's probably not going to happen.
Chastity Pratt Dossie, Bridge Magazine. Always great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Creation.
Vision.
The next idea.
What they have helped us do is to really think in a totally different way about how to deliver and create something new.
When we hear talk of innovation, that talk tends to center on high-tech ideas produced by places like Ann Arbor or Silicon Valley, areas with a strong foundation in higher education and lots of access to venture capitalists and their money. But our latest contributor to the next idea poses an interesting question. What about the innovation that can come from the grassroots? You don't necessarily need a university degree to hit on an innovative idea. Shobhita Parthasarathy is an associate professor of public policy and women's studies at the University of Michigan. Shobhita believes we could learn some valuable lessons in the way India supports and nurtures its grassroots innovators, and it's good to have you with us on The Next Idea.
It's great to be here.
As kids, you know, we learn about the great inventors in school, and certainly recently we envision innovators as being from the great research universities like U of M. So how do you think this perception of innovators as the elite few it holds us back in our search for new innovations?
So I think it's a wonderful question. And I think, in fact, we not only tend to think about the great innovators, but when we think of those great innovators, we tend to think about them as a pretty homogenous group, right? I mean, in terms of gender, in terms of race. I mean, I remember as a child interested in science and technology, holding fast to Marie Curie because she was the sole woman who seemed to be engaged in this space.
Not that we're saying anything against, you know, the white males.
No,
that
not
have,
at all. Not,
have blazed the path, but
not
yes.
Not at all, right? But I think the point is that, to me, mm-hmm. as a child, made me think, wait a second, this is available for me too. I could do this potentially, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that some of the challenges that we've had in diversifying STEM education in part relates to this, right? Which is that if we don't, as children or as young adults or as people thinking about college degrees, see people who look like us in that inventive space, then it's difficult for us to imagine ourselves kind of participating in that. Mm-hmm. And I think that the second part of that is that we also tend not to think about innovation as being sort of incremental, low cost, things that can just be mild improvements on our everyday lives. And so we think we tend to hold innovation in this huge, oh, I have to invent the iPad or the, you know, or the new computer or a new semiconductor. No, it could be, you know, a waterproof wheelchair, for example, right? That also, the sort of scope of what innovation can be, can also potentially diversify the kinds of people who are engaged in that practice.
Now, on the next idea, we have talked about this idea, the idea of innovation from the margins. What kind of skills and ideas do you think we're missing when we don't talk to people who are, as you put it, knowledge rich and resource poor, which really sums it up?
Yeah, I think I agree. And I guess I would kind of answer that in two ways. The first is that we all have very different experiences based on who we are, where we grew up, what kind of education we have, whether or not we have a disability. And those kinds of experiences and our socioeconomic status, right, those kinds of experiences mean that we experience the world differently and see opportunities for science and technology very differently. Mm-hmm. And often those kinds of things don't get reflected into the marketplace as easily. We don't necessarily see the products that we need in the marketplace, in part because we individually don't necessarily constitute a giant market or the most lucrative market, right? So those kinds of technologies don't get produced. I think the other part of this is it's not just about promoting knowledge from the margins or people who are knowledge rich or resource poor, but also thinking about the policy frameworks that we need to develop in order to promote innovation from those places, right? That not only from those places, but innovation that is potentially in the public interest more directly, that benefits society more directly, even promote social justice goals. And we tend to think about science and technology policies as being what are called push policies. We sort of fund research, or we, you know, have a really strong patent system. But what if we were to think about it in terms of, well, you know, maybe we should think about what kinds of research we fund a little bit differently. And maybe we should think about intellectual property in different contexts and for different kinds of things to be somewhat different, to be modular potentially, right? Or maybe we should think about research labs as being kind of in service of some of this kind of grassroots innovation rather than always being at the leading edge of science and technology themselves.
And to that, you take us to India, and you write in your essay about the National Innovation Foundation. It's actually a government organization. Tell us, what does it do?
So it does some of the things that I just mentioned. So the National Innovation Foundation itself has been around for about 16 years. And until then, there were a number of NGOs that were developed by a professor at one of the big business schools in India. And the idea behind this is the notion of knowledge rich and resource poor is really his idea and their idea. But what they promote is meeting innovators where they are. That's sort of also what they talk about. And they want to scout innovation. So they go, one of the most interesting things is that every year they go to a different part of rural India and they just take walks and they engage with the public to sort of find out what the public is doing and how to empower them as individuals, but also empower them as communities. They then choose a subset of those inventions and they, you know, try to systematize them and help bring them into the innovation space. But then in bringing them into the innovation space, it isn't exactly the way we tend to think about innovation in the sense that the idea is to get the best entrepreneur to license it and to make the
piles of money.
Exactly. I mean, that's not, it's not,
not a bad thing, but
it's not only not a bad thing. It's not that they're not doing that. Mm. They are doing that. But in developing these kinds of licensing agreements, they are also, for example, ensuring that there's some kind of what they call benefit sharing. So that not only the inventor, but sometimes, but the community gets some benefit. They're only investing in certain kinds of very sustainable technologies that have the promise of that kind of public benefit. And finally, this is where, you know, what I said earlier comes in as well. If an innovation isn't ripe for a patent or isn't ripe for an entrepreneur, their ideology is such that they say, you know, we still want to disseminate knowledge about this technology. We still want to valorize it. We don't want to, you know, just extract from the community and be done with
and
it.
Move
if, right, and move on. Mm-hmm. We want to translate information about it into all of the many languages in India. We want to give this kind of information out to multiple people so that other communities can either build upon that technology, but also that, just like to go back to the Marie Curie example, that they see innovators in their own community and they see it as potentially a goal that they can achieve too, right, to innovate themselves.
So it could be some small thing, as you say in your essay, some farmer may have come up with a way to solve a problem.
Right.
And that's discovered because here you've got these National Innovation Foundation officials doing walk-arounds and finding that. That's a little hard to think of happening in this country, but it does send such a strong message to people, doesn't it?
I think it does. And, you know, we still tend to – it's funny. On the one hand, this is a very bottom-up, grassroots country, in many ways very similar to India in that it promotes individualism and self-determination and, you know, individual grit. We're really into that in the United States, just as they are in India. But on the other hand, when we think about our approaches to science and technology policy, they tend to be, I wouldn't necessarily say top-down, but based on sort of an elite vision of who mm-hmm. should participate. And what's interesting about the Indian approach is that they're saying, well, that part shouldn't be based on the elites either, right? We should also be thinking about that in terms of bottom-up.
Can we learn these lessons from India and apply them in Michigan?
I think so. There are at least a couple of ways that I think we can just engage in little tweaks in the things that we're already doing. So one thing that has kind of taken the U.S. and a lot of the developing world by storm, or the developed world by storm, I should say, are these things called makerspaces. So makerspaces, we have them in Michigan. They are usually community gatherings where people get together and they tinker, right? So in theory, it sounds very similar to the Indian approach, but in practice, they tend to be, you know, people who are technically trained, somewhat homogenous in terms of their makeup, and not necessarily public interest focused, but rather more entrepreneurship focused, right? So I could imagine, for example, thinking about some of those being recast as public interest makerspaces, right, with a more explicit public interest or social justice focus that maybe says, you know, we're not going to focus on, you know, doing biotechnological tinkering or tinkering with semiconductors. You know, we want to foster the kinds of low-cost, low-tech innovation that is already probably taking place in people's homes around our community, but that we don't have the spaces to really find and valorize. So that's one kind of place I think we can think about it. And I think the second is then to take that innovation and ensure that we have the supportive policy and programmatic frameworks to make sure that those innovations that have that kind of public interest in mind actually have the opportunity to be disseminated, right? That they get supported in some way, that they have support to create licensing agreements with companies to ensure that yeah. they can both make a little bit of money, but also potentially serve some of these social benefit
and
goals
bring
this way.
More people into the tent.
Potentially. Yeah,
potentially.
That's the hope, right? Is that more people engaging in innovation means that we're more likely to see ourselves and be inspired.
Shobita Parathsarathy is an associate professor of public policy and women's studies at the University of Michigan. You'll find her essay on grassroots innovation on the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. We welcome your thoughts, your comments there, or Michigan Radio's Facebook page, or on Twitter at NextIdeaMI. Shobita, thank you so much for being with us.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for having me.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Melissa Benmark, Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.